I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, listeners, I want to thank our good friends at Slipped Disc for their enthusiastic support of Speaking Soundly. Be sure to check out slippeddisc.com for the latest inside information on classical music now. Today's episode continues our celebration of Black History Month with the incredible virtuoso clarinetist Anthony McGill. Clarinetist and Avery Fisher Prize winner Anthony McGill is the first African-American principal player in the New York Philharmonic's 180-year history. He feels a deep responsibility to use his singular presence on stage to educate and inspire a new generation of diverse musicians.
It's a hope that kids have an opportunity to see someone that looks like them on a stage of a classical music hall by being a representative of what's possible, but also giving them a chance to see, look, I can do anything I want.
You're listening to Speaking Soundly, a backstage pass to today's biggest stars of the music world. I'm your host, David Krause, principal trumpet of the Metropolitan Opera. During each episode, you'll hear me speak with inspiring performers about their creative process and the personal journey that led them to the stage. It's great to see you and to talk to you. Of course, we were colleagues together at the Metropolitan Opera before you moved to the New York Philharmonic, and we shared a lot of amazing performances together, although I don't think I've ever been as awestruck by a colleague's performance as when I saw you perform at the inauguration of Barack Obama back in 2009. Can you tell me what that experience was like for you?
It was probably the highlight of my life, you know, just being asked to be part of that moment that was so historic. And as a child, I would have never imagined that I would have been a part of something like that. You know, I might, as a clarinet player, as a musician, I might as well have been elected president. That's what that's what it felt like. You know, everything we do as performers is just to have those moments on stage, quote unquote. But that was probably the greatest stage of my life. And it just meant so much to me, just as a American, as a Black American, with Obama being elected and being there for that moment.
That's incredible. I rewatched it recently. And the thing is, there's a moment where you're playing and Obama turns around to watch you. He takes a moment of solitude while listening to you play. That's amazing. I mean, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it is so unreal, you know, to think about it. And I mean, it's just to set the stage for people that haven't seen the video. We were up on this like platform in front of the Capitol, and all of the VIPs and the senators and the president to be is like all like behind us in this like bowl like area. So we're like up on this stage that's higher than everyone by quite a bit. And it's crazy because we had the best seats for that inauguration.
Were you able to take in the moment, or was it just surreal?
It was hard to process because it was just happening and we were there for it. But it was almost like when someone goes into shock from pain, but this was the opposite of that. This was like, I didn't feel anything because it was freezing cold, but also I was, the emotion of the moment, the meaning of the moment was like kind of overwhelming, I think. So I knew I would process it later, and I still don't think I've processed that moment. I'll be remembering that in years to come.
And you might say that the other time you were in the middle of a historic event was the fact that you grew up in Chicago during the Bulls' three-peat championship runs. What was it like to be a kid in the 80s and 90s in Chicago watching Michael Jordan and that dynasty?
I mean, I think that actually, that like defined so many kids' childhood. I mean, they defined my childhood for sure. As a kid from the South Side, the Bulls represented so much, but Michael Jordan and the Bulls together represented that it was possible to win, you know? It was possible to like achieve absolute greatness. Not to take that too far, but to take it too far. Like there were so many, I was lucky because my brother and I had positive role models at home. Mm-hmm. And we were surrounded by, you know, some positive role models. But to see Michael Jordan and to kind of be a Chicagoan and in the back of our house, we grew up, you know, in a, you know, neighborhood with small brick bungalow homes. And in the backyard, my dad built this makeshift basketball hoop back there, like in front of our garage. We had garages and in between was the backyard. But we had this little patio in front of the backyard where you could have a grill or something. But he put up a basketball hoop. And that was just amazing because we felt like we were privileged because we had a basketball hoop, even though we weren't. We didn't have very much money, but my parents made us feel like we did. And that was a part of my childhood, was growing up pretending to be Michael Jordan, pretending to be Walter Payton. That helped develop self-esteem, frankly. So between the Michael Jordans of the world and others, I had positive role models around, that whole concept of you can really do amazing things with your life. The thing that anything is possible, and like learning about how hard they worked and learning about their failures and seeing their interviews and seeing people talk about working really hard for success. This was something that was talked about a lot in our family.
Well, you're from Chicago. I'm from New York, but both of us as very young kids ended up in the woods of Michigan to attend a summer camp called Interlaken. Could you, first of all, just summarize what Interlaken meant to you and what was your experience like there?
Yeah, so they have all the arts, dance, music, drama, all of that stuff. And for 8 weeks, I went away at age 11. Which is kind of shocking to think about now because it was a sleepaway camp. And at the time, it was 8 weeks for kids, probably from age, what, seven, six? Wow, my daughter's almost six. And I'm like, that's crazy.
Could you imagine shipping her off for eight weeks?
For eight weeks? Whoa. That's crazy to think about. But it was a great place. The most fun part was like becoming like an independent little person. So I remember just kind of being alone for those weeks. That was wild.
My summer there made me realize that if I didn't practice as much as everybody else, like I was going to fall way behind. What was practicing like for you growing up? Did you have parents that insisted you practice every day or did you do it on your own?
Well, first of all, my parents weren't those kind of folks. So that wasn't a thing. They just wanted us to follow through with stuff. So at some point, we like had like a little chart on the wall we had to check off and we practiced every day. So it was just like, yeah, you wanted to be consistent with it. But I think for the most part, pretty self-motivated because I liked playing. I think I discovered that I really, really enjoyed getting better at the clarinet. And early on, some of the stuff probably came easy to me. I didn't realize that at the time. Partly why it probably was enjoyable for me is that I liked to read when I was young and I enjoyed reading and I felt a similar kind of affinity for music and finding out what the story was, what the piece sounded like.
And just technically on the instrument, was there a point in your development where you felt like the practice that you were doing really started to pay off, like things finally started to click?
Yeah. There were a couple, you know, big moments, and I look at it in kind of like repertoire. At 15, specifically, I started learning the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto, which was like one of the hardest pieces ever written for the clarinet. And that's when everything kind of like, I knew, okay, I'm putting in 4 or 5 hours a day practicing to learn this piece note by note, trying to do something I'd never done before. And to learn that piece, I had to take a humongous jump. When I think about it now, these were pieces that were way out of my league, but I don't know if I knew that at the time. I don't know if my teachers were just like, yeah, sure, whatever you want to do, or they just recognized that I had this skill that needed to be nourished. But looking back on it, it seems those pieces in particular seem very odd for a young person to be playing.
Right. You know, it seems like from a very early age that you set forth on this path to become who you are today. Obviously, there was a lot of hard work and perseverance that went into it. But were there bumps in the road to this eventual success?
Yeah, there were lots of bumps in the road, probably too many to list, you know. They seem large at the time, but they're small, but they mean something in your on your journey to where you end up. But one of the first times I played at this competition, I had a memory slip and I was like kind of devastated, but I had practiced what I thought was a lot. And I was really sad about it. I was probably like 11 or something. And backstage, Michael Morgan, who was the conductor of the youth orchestra, who was putting on this competition, came back and talked to me. And he talked to my mom and he told us that the result of the thing doesn't really matter because I was playing music. I was playing musically like a musician. And I remembered that. I remember that to this day, that the pursuit of perfection, or what we think of perfection, isn't the thing that is the most valued. It is how you express yourself on your instrument. And so I've always remembered that. That was a huge kind of fail. I didn't win the thing. I don't know if I even got an honorable mention. And so there were many competitions like that.
That made an impact on you at 11? That would have just destroyed me at age 11. But that brought you comfort to know? I mean, that's pretty mature.
I don't know if it brought me comfort. And I think I was very upset still. But I do remember it. And I think I remembered it all throughout that time, because it's a story also that my mom talked to me about a lot. We talked about that moment. And so whether it's the memory that is actually from that time, or it's the memory that I carried with me in all those early years of any time I would struggle, I would remember some of those ideas. Also, there are so many moments where you fail that no one knows about, that don't seem like a big deal to anyone else. They would never know about them, whether it's a competition, you know, or there were lots of people that made fun of me being a clarinet player, like when I was a kid. That's another thing that's kind of like, that was a constant in my childhood, in my early years as a musician, being bullied for it, being made fun of. Like this happened a lot. And it happened so much that I feel like blocked it out. So I've discovered in later years, that's something I do remember.
But you think that was more than the average, because I was called a band nerd and things like that. But you're saying this went clearly beyond that.
Yeah, I think it did, actually. Recently, I looked at my 8th grade like autograph book, and I had some stuff written in there by quote-unquote friends that was not okay, like not okay at all. And my mom and my parents like thought that it was time for me to leave that school. It was a very good school. But the way she tells the story is that I came home and like my jacket was torn and I was starting to get in some trouble. I thought it was just like typical wrestling with people and playing with your friends. But really, I think it was probably like what you would be called today bullying. You know, people trying to like body slam you in the bathroom is probably not normal. I thought it was probably just like, oh, yeah, just playing around with, you know, the other guys in school and stuff. But that kind of stuff was happening. And it's like, that's not actually normal. You were being bullied hard. So some of that is from, you know, clarinet playing, and I was little as well. I didn't join the football team. But sometimes when you're living your life, you don't even identify as the thing that people would say are those hardships. Or, like, for instance, when you're taking auditions and you're not winning them, or you're getting discouraged and getting really upset by that, all those things could have been moments where a lot of us could just say, I'm not doing this anymore. I was just talking to all the clarinet students at Juilliard the other day, and I was like, by the way, everybody, if you take two auditions or three auditions and you don't advance, don't stop playing the clarinet. And it's a funny thing to say, but it doesn't take 40 failures for you to do that. Sometimes it just takes two or three or four to be like, I'm done with this.
Right. So you've been at the New York Philharmonic now for 8 years. Here's a couple facts about your presence there. You're the first Black principal player in the New York Philharmonic's history, and you're the only current Black member of the orchestra. I mean, that's outrageous just to say. How does it make you feel?
I hear it, and I'm like, I can't process it. But when I think about it, it sounds really shocking and surprising. And if I go deeper, it's kind of disturbing. And at the same time, I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I'm really grateful that I have this chance, this opportunity to be this person and play clarinet and be in that role. It's kind of sad in some way, you know, because you think about the history in our country of segregation, and segregation affected, it affected the South, it affected the North, that racism affected America. And that affects the business of making music, actually. And it's something people don't touch on enough. For instance, the whole concept that when I was growing up, like, music was taken out of the schools in the inner city. And that the only reason I'm playing clarinet is because of a program that gave me the opportunity to play music. When Chicago or many cities were majority white, the school system gave that money to educate kids with music and art and everything else.
And it flourished.
And it flourished. I meet people, my friends all the time, older white people in America that are my close friends. They're like, I can't believe everyone doesn't have music like we used to. You know, we know all these people. Like, we got music in the schools, and it's not a coincidence, you know? And if you go deep into all of that stuff, you're like, oh, okay, I see what's going on. And you had separate unions and stuff for Black people and white people in New York and other cities, big cities, because people weren't allowed, even if we wanted to go join the New York Philharmonic, there's no way you're going to be able to. So the Anthony McGills of that time could not have joined the New York Philharmonic. People just, like, don't want to talk about that.
Right. It takes a lot to achieve what you've done as a performing artist and a teacher. It's a full-time job for anybody. Do you feel an added responsibility just being the sole Black musician on stage?
I think not so much, because I feel like sometimes it's a burden we carry, a burden that lots of people of color understand in a way, that is a part of existence. And so, yes, that can be tiresome, definitely. But that's something that I've known for a very long time before I got to the position that I currently occupy. And so that success, I guess, carries its own responsibilities. It's probably something that my parents instilled in me as well, as a responsibility to the community of people that I grew up in who have been categorized by their skin color. So part of that responsibility that I have taken on as kind of a personal mission, which makes it not so much like a burden, not so much like a heavy lift, but that's something that gives me real pride, is to try to help others. And I mean, you know, you teach the younger generation too. I've been doing work with programs all over the country and world. Whenever I travel, try to go to schools and do that kind of work. And I've volunteered for different programs that are doing the kind of grassroots work that I started at in Chicago. People gave me an opportunity. They saw promise in me. They saw that with attention and nourishment, kids can do great things. So that's why I do work at the Juilliard School's Music Advancement Program, where we try to reach kids typically underserved by classical music. It's a really amazingly diverse group of kids. We look at the whole family. We look at the resources that they have. We look at where they come from, and most importantly, how much talent they have to grow in music and give them opportunity. And that's what people did for me when I was growing up. So that's not a burden at all.
When you walk into Juilliard, there's a huge poster of you standing with all the young students of the Music Advancement Program. I know you're doing a lot of work with that particular program to hopefully change the tide of what the eventual student population is going to look like at conservatories like Juilliard and other performing arts schools. Do you feel like it's working?
It's really interesting because I have no idea if it's working. I can't sit here and give you like a huge pitch about how what we're going to do is going to change the face of classical music in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But it's a hope that kids have an opportunity to see someone that looks like them on a stage of a classical music hall by being a representative of what's possible, but also giving them a chance to see, look, I can do anything I want. And so a classical music program isn't going to erase racism. The issue for populating our stages with more diverse people, that's an issue that orchestras have to deal with themselves as organizations. Institutions themselves actually have to deal with, what do we really want? I know everybody wants the best talent. Everybody wants the best performances. But also, if you want orchestras to look differently, then you would actually have to deal with examining how you do that in a really effective way. Things aren't done in isolation. Everybody in their different groups likes to point fingers and say, oh no, it's this part, early education, that's the thing that'll cure the problem. But like I said, this whole concept of prejudice and denial of access to things, it happens on every different level. If I look at my 22-year career, I look at how many people were given a chance that were not Black, brown, Asian, female, queer. They weren't given a chance because they were assumed not to be good enough for that opportunity. As we know, there are plenty of conductors that get up in front of us that were definitely not exceptional.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And it's curious. No one ever questions why they were given that opportunity. And so there's this backlash where it's always a harsher critic that comes to play. They're saying, oh, well, we believe in equality and everything, but this woman conductor was terrible. Why did she get this opportunity? And it's like, wait a second, horrible male white conductors have been given that opportunity for hundreds of years. So that's the thing that we don't discuss enough.
Right. I want to talk for a minute about this video that you made at the beginning of the pandemic. It's you alone playing America the Beautiful, and you leave the end unresolved. You don't play the last notes. And instead of finishing it, you kneel down and you take to your knees. It's hauntingly played and really very poignant. Can you talk to me about how that video came about and the artistic choices that led to it?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I was devastated and depressed like every other musician, every other person possibly in the world about what was going on, and had gotten to a point where I was like just okay with that. Just like, all right, I'm not working as a musician. I was comfortable at here at home. But when George Floyd was killed, I, like a lot of people, were really traumatized by that. And I'd taken a couple days before I'd seen the video, and then I finally watched it. And it was just, I couldn't really describe in words what was going on and how I felt. So I woke up one night, middle of the night, and I started writing something about this concept of why people are protesting this. Why are people hurt by this? And I wrote some words about the whole backlash against Black Lives Matters and why there was backlash there. And I was like, well, it's because it doesn't seem like Black lives have ever mattered. And this is an example of that, like on TV, on our phones, on our computers, and in every way, I was like, there's one reason why that was able to happen. Because in America, for so many of us, Black lives don't matter. And it's a, that was a public expression of that. And that's how it felt. So I talked about Colin Kaepernick and how he tried to take a knee and people go to the opposite, which is that he's disrespecting the flag. So the concept came because I was sitting out here trying to process my thoughts about this. And then I decided to say, let's take two knees for justice and equality. And part of that came from, honestly, from reading this book by Henry Thames, who's the president of Lincoln Center, called New Power, about how the world has changed so much because individuals have power, much more power than they ever used to. And I was thinking about this as a musician and how to use that. And so that's how the process of making it into like this thing that I could put on the internet that I can invite people to join. If you agree that everyone deserves a chance to live, you can use your power of music to express things, that protest in that way is not bad, not radical, not anything, but something that we should all be able to get behind. So I challenged the whole world to do that, the whole classical music world, and people stepped up. Within the day, Lincoln Center, all of these classical organizations started posting things on their sites of association with why Black Lives Matter to their organizations, which they had never, ever done before. And musician friends and colleagues and amateurs and people I didn't know all over the country and the world started placing these videos of Take Two Knees on their own personal pages. And it was really, really powerful because it felt like people heard and felt the pain that a lot of us were experiencing, and maybe for the first time.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Soundly. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Be sure to follow, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up on future episodes, follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY and visit our website, artfulnarrativesmedia.com. Tune in next week as we hear another inspiring artist speaking soundly.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.